Blog Talk Radio.
I'd like to welcome everybody today to this episode of On Point with your host, Don Allen. That's me and Mr. Ron Edwards. How are you doing today, Mr. Edwards?
Fine, Mr. Allen. Kind of a dreary, overcast day here in the Twin Cities. Now, this kind of looks like late fall. This looks like October in Minnesota. The prediction had been for rain, as you know. We haven't seemed to have gotten that in the Twin Cities here. We're also checking the weather channels and et cetera, but it is not. This looks like fall, okay?
Yeah. It sure is feeling outside like a little bit like fall. And I want to let people know we're broadcasting live from the McIntosh Studios in beautiful downtown Minneapolis, overlooking the city, the west of the city. And I guess we'd want to go into some international news first, Mr. Edwards.
Yes, we do. One of the things we want to say in that overlooking the downtown area. As you know, President Barack Obama was in the Twin Cities today. That created some problems for folks who were going to the Minnesota Gopher game. As you know, the Gophers fired their coach at the conclusion of their game last Saturday, Tim Brewster, out after basically 3.5 years. 1-6 record, now 1-7, by the way. Gophers lost again. But the president was in town campaigning for former United States Senator, now running for governor, Mark Dayton, okay?
Okay.
And apparently a big turnout. I guess we'll be getting the actual figures over the next number of hours. But on to the international piece, Mr. Allen, a very disturbing report, actually a series of documents, in excess of 1,700 pages or et cetera, according to the New York Times and the AP and et cetera, dealing with the conflict in the Middle East and particularly the cover-up that was the Iraqi campaign, as they like to refer to it. The documents basically show, as I know I talked about as a journalist 7 or 8 years ago, that the numbers and the deaths of Iraqi nationals and others was far in excess of what we were being told in the American public. These secret documents, which someone has if you will, acquired, or as the British like to say, pinched from the Pentagon, show in excess of 100,000 Iraqis being killed. It also shows brutal and repressive acts of the Iraqi paramilitary forces that was suppressed, if you will, by the United States. It also confirms what I think many of us journalists knew, that the Iranians have, in fact, been fully engaged in assisting elements. Now, notice the word we use, elements of the insurgency inside of Iraq. This is Iraq now. And the documents, the archives, very frightening with respect to what happened under the Bush administration. Of course, some of this is now spilled over to President Barack Obama. We would like to think that maybe 2 or 3 years from now, when some more papers are leaked, that it will indicate that he and Secretary Gates, that's Defense Secretary Gates, did everything they could to kind of push this down, eliminate these human rights violations, and et cetera. But the documents, the archives, as they're referred to, very, very disturbing with respect to the level of brutality and misinformation, Mr. Allen, that was provided and has been provided to the American people over a decade. By the way, understand that we are in now to the 10th year of the conflict in Afghanistan.
Yes.
It's been 10 years. Which I maintain, just on another kind of note, that kind of ongoing conflict does all kinds of strange things to the psychology of a nation. And, you know, a lot of discussion about violence, and there's a lot of violence going on in this country that really doesn't get major coverage, if you will, but there's a lot more violence going on than we are alerted to as the general public. And I got to tell you, after 10 years of conflict, that begins to leave a scar on the psyche of a people and a nation, and somebody better try to take a look at that. Your beloved Vikings, tomorrow night, Sunday, in Green Bay, Brett Favre, he of the, let me tweet something to you, sweetie fame, if you will, will be at quarterback for the Vikings as they attempt to close the gap in the race for the NFC North. My prediction is Green Bay by 3 points, if you will. It'll be interesting to see what Brett Favre's level of concentration is in that very crucial game tomorrow in Lambeau Field, Green Bay. So that's kind of the update, but I want to reemphasize the archives, the Pentagon Papers, the new Pentagon Papers, raise some very troubling questions and a very troubling picture of America's conducting of the conflict in the Middle East. Okay?
Yes, I agree 100% with that. And then we have to move on. We have some historical moments in sports or in baseball here this week with the Rangers.
Yes, the Texas Rangers win the American League pennant, first time in the history of that franchise, and that franchise has actually been in existence since 1961. They were the old Washington Senators, if you will, or forerunner of the old Washington Senators, because the original Washington Senators came here and became the Minnesota Twins. Back in the day, in the 60s, they tried to put another franchise in Washington. It only lasted to about 1971. Then it just upped and moved to Texas. But for the purposes of historical import, the current Texas Ranger organization indicates its identity to the 1961 Washington Senators. Ron Washington, a former player, very well-respected, well-liked player for the Minnesota Twins a number of years ago, the manager of the Texas Rangers. And our research right here, some quick research, though the last manager of color was Ozzie Guillen of the Chicago White Sox, I think it was the 2006 series. But Ron Washington appears to be the first African-American manager to take his team into the World Series. But whichever way that this would play out, if we are incorrect, we are continuing to take a look at the Guinness Book of Sports, if you will. But it appears that Ron Washington is the first African-American, native-born American of African descent to take a team into the World Series. And I got to tell you that this is monumental, because Ron almost lost his job earlier this year before the season started because of a situation a couple years before where he tested positive. And as you've always said, Mr. Allen, we want to be transparent. Ron Washington tested positive for cocaine.
Yes.
And at some point, there were some conservative sportscasts, as others were demanding that he should be made an example of. It was really his players, led by Michael Young, one of the white players of the Texas Rangers, but one of their most steadfast players, who rallied the troops, if you will, and indicated that everyone is allowed a mistake. And so fate, as it would be, allowed Ron Washington to continue as manager. So a lot of happiness down there in Arlington, Texas. That's actually the home of the Texas Rangers. For those that are from the Dallas-Fort Worth area, as you know, Arlington is the little town in between Fort Worth and Dallas, so, you know, folks don't get confused. But anyways, our congratulations. We had a chance to meet Ron Washington, kind of knew him in those days when he was a younger man. He was a utility player here with the Minnesota Twins. But we're just happy for him, Mr. Allen.
Yeah, I agree 100% with you on that. Congratulations. Also, another note, I like, speaking of politics, just jumping back and forth here, Bill Clinton, Mr. Edwards, will be in town tomorrow. He'll be out in Blaine at Teamsters Local 120 at 7 p.m. They're having a tailgate party. And they're going to watch the football game, and this is on behalf of Terrell Clark, who is running against Michelle Bachmann.
Yes. Michelle Bachmann, the devil lady up there in the sixth congressional district.
Yeah, and then there's a quote here that says Bill Clinton calls Michelle's ideology pretty stupid, and so that should be pretty interesting tomorrow night. And they were wondering how they were going to make that work out because of the game being on, and no one wants to, go to a political function, and there's Vikings are playing Green Bay, which is one of the biggest games of the year.
That's so, right, both for the professional team, correct. Mm-hmm.
You just kind of put it all in one, where they could do a tailgate party and watch the game right after. And so that's up in Blaine, local Teamsters 120, and that is open to the public.
Oh, okay. So if folks want to go up and see former President Bill Clinton, and support Ms. Clark in her run against one of the most conservative members of the House of Representatives, hey, be my guest.
Okay, now, Ms. Earls, I was just, someone had just sent me something right before the show that I would like to, you know, and I'm just looking at it right now. On eBay, the website that sells different items, they are selling a racist children's book, an old book, for $1,300. It's called 10 Little N-Boys. I'm not going to say the words.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Gotcha, gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's very interesting that they're doing that because they have it up right now to $1,300. And it looks pretty popular, but you can check that out by going to eBay if you choose and maybe sending eBay a letter and asking them or email why they're doing that. So
now, was this a book that was in the estate of Stonewall Jackson or Robert E. Lee or somebody?
Where did they get the book from? Yeah, eBay does not have all the details, but it just I'm just basically right now looking at the ad. It's a looks like a 10-page book and it has a 10 black children on a teeter totter, five on each side, and and it says 10 little N boys sitting down to dine. One of them choked himself, and now there was nine.
Okay.
And then the number nine, nine little N boys stayed up very late. One overslept. And now there were eight. And it's kind of like a book like that, and it's very disgusting, and I just saw
and
that.
And it's supposed to be a children's book, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, it used to be, that kind of material used to be very prevalent in the libraries, both the public libraries and the libraries of white schools in the South and some northern enclaves. I can well remember many, many, many years ago, controversy. We're talking at this point the very late 1940s, early 50s, 51, 52, because there were some of those books in some of the libraries here in Minnesota. And there would be some controversy. In fact, I think in some situations they didn't purge that book, that specific book. There were a couple of others using the word, the N-word, if you will. Usually had the little Negro children, extremely dark, big eyes, big lips, had the hair in quote unquote different pigtails, if you will. Very condescending on one hand, very ugly with respect to attacking children, if you will. But it was very popular in this country, throughout this country. But it was heavily concentrated in the South. But believe my friend that it existed here in libraries here in Minnesota. In fact, one of the things that was the platform of the late Nellie Stone Johnson, who was the third elected black public official in the history of Minnesota, when she won the library seat here in Minneapolis in 1944, she was talking in terms of getting rid of material like that was in the Minneapolis library.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, there is a story, as I reflect back now, look at some documents. There was a story in the Minneapolis Journal, which was the prime newspaper along with the Star and along with the Tribune, along with the Minneapolis Times, during the war years, 1943, because the argument, rightly so, by Nellie Stone Johnson, the late Cecil Newman, the powerful publisher of the Minneapolis Spokesman Recorder, was that given the call by President Franklin Delano Roosevelt for the nation to pull together, we were now in what, quote-unquote, year two of the Second World War, that these kinds of publications were unpatriotic. And at that particular point, that argument resonated with a lot of different people. And so Nellie Stone Johnson was using that as her platform as she was elected to the school board in 1944. At the same time, she was helping to found, if you will, what is now known as the Democratic Farmer Labor Party. Interesting history. Appreciate you bringing it up, Mr. Al.
Yeah, I just wanted to get it, slide that in. Well, we had a lot of interesting things go on this week, Mr. Edwards, from the meeting that you and I attended about the history of North Minneapolis at the University of Minnesota's Urban Research Outreach and Enrichment Center in North Minneapolis.
Talk to us a little bit about that. Talk to us a little bit.
Okay, well, here's what it was. TPT Channel 2 is planning on going back with the producer-director Daniel Pierce Bergman to do a documentary on North Minneapolis. They want to talk about you know, the richness of North Minneapolis, you know, what happened. You know, there was a large Jewish community in North Minneapolis with riots, and they just want to go back. But if those people that want to check out former State Representative Willie Ostateen, Willie Dominguez, for 58B in North Minneapolis, actually brought a newspaper where his mother and he was on the cover, and he was just born. He's number 18 out of 19. And if you go to IBNNnews.com, that's IBNNnews.com, you can actually see the interview that I did with him and actually see that newspaper where he was on the cover as a baby, as a newborn, with his mother.
August of 1955, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, yes, absolutely correct.
Okay.
And it gives the details, and there's also a link to Mr. Daniel Pierce Bergden's YouTube channel where you can kind of get to know him. His brother works for Channel 2 here in Twin Cities, in St. Paul, and he's put together quite a few documentaries, The North Star, Minnesota's Black Pioneers, and worked on a lot of things. And this should be proved to be pretty interesting, and they want to hear the stories from people in the community. So, and this also, Mr. Edwards, reminds me of the Northside Marketing Task Force, who is basically now defunct. But that's one of the things that they were vetted to do for North Minneapolis, is to get the older generation, the mid generation, and then the children to kind of come in and tell their stories about North Minneapolis. But of course, this hasn't developed, and so the giant, the University of Minnesota, has stepped in to make this happen, and as they should at this point.
Yes, in fact, Vice President Robert Jones. In fact, really, it was kind of it's I guess every Wednesday at UROC, we have what is kind of called the Robert Jones Hour, and Vice President Jones has or is facilitating a number of formats, if you will, for discussions relevant to the health and wellness, if you will, I guess, of the Northside community. It was a well-attended meeting. I think I counted approximately 33, 34 people in the room, well-attended. It'll be interesting to see just how the producer – by the way, the producer is the same producer that produced the award-winning documentary North Star, for our local listeners here in Minnesota. Produced the North Star was a documentary on the migration of the Negro, quote unquote, into Minnesota, back even when it was a territory, if you will. And so the young man in question that you mentioned earlier has a outstanding reputation of being able to put together a quality kind of documentary and et cetera. And so, you know, I really, as an old veteran, if you will, as one who has lived in community since 1945, I'm really looking forward to see how that will be handled, how much reflections we will have on the original 6th Avenue North, which was the Wall Street, Black Wall Street of Minnesota, particularly from the period basically from 1917 to 1950-51, when quote-unquote urban renewal basically wiped it out, if you will. So I'm really looking forward to that history, to the many businesses, if you will, very prosperous businesses, Mr. Allen, that existed for 25, 30, 35 years.
Okay, and I agree, and we're going to look forward to keep close tabs on that and also let our listeners know, you know, keep them updated.
Could we shoot the phone number to them? We've been remiss. We haven't given the phone number out.
Yes, if you'd like to call in, dial 1-877-572-4288. Again, that toll-free number to On Point is 1-877-572-4288. And, you know, we'll take your calls. If you have a question or comment or a suggestion, we'll be glad to give you the platform.
And we want to emphasize that that's a toll-free number for our international and domestic audiences.
Yes, it is.
Yes, sir. Go ahead, Mr. Allen. Okay. I'll cut you off. Sorry, sir.
Oh, no problem. I was just going to give the number one more time, 1-877-572-4288. And I see a number of listeners in the chat room. Feel free to call if you have a question. Getting back into the news, Mr. Edwards, I didn't ask you your opinion on this, but I wrote a one heck of a story about the firing of Juan Williams from NPR, which was a big news item this week. And I just, you know, the story of my title is, you know, it's not Mom and Dad's America anymore. And out of the comments he made and out of some of the stuff that came from the opinion and news website called Sodahead, actually published word for word how he prefaced what he said before he said it. Now, some people think that this is wrong, and he wasn't on NPR when he said it, but he was on Bill O'Reilly's show, and I just see him personally, this is kind of where me and my wife disagree, but I'll just share this with you. I see him personally as a black success story, because NPR let him go, and he immediately got a contract for $2 million with Fox.
Well, let me just say, for transparency, Fox renewed his contract for an increase of $2 million.
Okay.
He was already under contract to Fox as a political commentator, and I thought that, you know, one of the things that you just said, and we saw some of the same tapes, Juan Williams yesterday was on, I think it was Good Morning America, and he said something that resonated, I know, with me as a longtime journalist when he said, I always thought, this is he, Juan Williams, he said, I always thought that it was the liberals that were in the forefront of freedom of speech and that the conservatives were the ones that were mean-spirited and blah, blah, blah. And he said, I guess that I was mistaken. And you know, you would start out by asking me the question of my own opinion and observation. You know, I just don't think that Juan Williams's comments, and I too have had a chance to take a look, not only the transcript, but I've seen a couple repeats of the particular interview. I don't know where it rolls to the threshold of terminating somebody's contract. Now, NPR has been pretty smooth on this, though, because they're now saying that they had warned Juan Williams on a number of occasions about incorporating his, quote-unquote, his personal views with his political commentary, et cetera. As you very eloquently pointed out, Juan Williams didn't make these comments on NPR, okay? He made them on Fox, where he is a contributing political correspondent, if you will, or contributor, political contributor, if you will. I just don't understand. I mean, you can do anything you want, I mean, in this country, but I just don't understand the legal issue here with respect to what they did. Now, what he said, I mean, come on. I mean, I can well remember, talked about it on our my own television program, Through My Eyes here in the Twin Cities. I talked about it in my columns in the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder, that folks were saying all kinds of things. In fact, for a couple years on Black Focus, we talked about the fact of the backlash and the very mean-spirited kinds of attacks against the Muslim population in this country. And people were – what Juan Williams said in 2010, people were being given accolades and medals for saying it in the period specifically from 2001 to, let's say, 2004, 2005, when they started getting concerned that there was a polarization taking place, and that in the Muslim world, in the world of Islam, people were saying that this was merely a war based on religion and color, right?
Yes.
So I'm like you. I don't know what your specific thinking is, Don. We haven't really discussed it. I know that you had an excellent piece that you just pointed out, but I don't know, and I think there was a little infringement, really, on Juan Williams's First Amendment rights. Now, let me say something else in closing on my observation. Last night on CNN, we had a chance to take a look at a broadcast in which a black female journalist who writes for I think it's the Washington Post, talked in terms, there had just been yesterday morning, Friday morning, there had been a meeting of some of the top black journalists in America. And obviously they were talking about what happened to Juan Williams. And she said something very interesting, and this has always been my take, that Juan Williams has basically been a conservative black commentator. Okay? Mm-hmm. He's displayed some fairly conservative thinking on different aspects of what goes on in America. At the same time, he hasn't forgotten his blackness. How he shades that blackness is his prerogative. And how he reflects on what it was that he was thinking when he was in an airport or on a plane, I don't know that we have the right to restrict that, and we certainly, I don't think, have the right to punish it.
I agree 100%. But, you know, I have a look back on this because I watched the interview of what he exactly said and what he stated, because he said he's wrote a number of books about the civil rights movement in this country. Okay.
Yes.
He says he's not a bigot. But what he's saying is what I see when I've probably taken, 15, 20 trips here in the last year or so. And and I sit back in the airport and I see it could be a Muslim and he's dressed in the garb. Okay? Then I look around. I see people start to whisper, all eyes on this gentleman. I mean, this year, you know, I mean, I'm just looking at him. Okay, this is a guy just getting on a plane, going on a business trip. He has a briefcase, so there's no reason really for me personally to fear a hijacking or anything like that. But I see people talking. One guy, a Caucasian gentleman that was sitting right next to me, said, oh, I hope we make it to our destination. And him and his buddy looked over at this guy, you know, in a long kind of, I don't know what they call it, but it looks like a long dress and, you know, his hat and so what?
We call them robes, a long robe.
So, yeah. And then what Mr. Williams said is what a lot of people have been thinking since 2001.
Absolutely.
And it wasn't a bigoted thing. It was just, you know, and then you get back to NPR and locally here, Minnesota Public Radio. I mean, why are they in such an uproar over that? They barely, you know, are rarely report on anything going on in the minority ethnic community. Matter of fact, I turned on NPR the last couple of days and Minnesota Public Radio, listen, and, you know, they're talking about giant pumpkins. And okay, well, that I can't relate to giant pumpkins at this point in my life. Is there some news that I could maybe use, you know,
right.
or my minority ethnic community? So, I mean, I just thought it was a racist, bigoted move by NPR, and I'm just glad to see him, you know, doing what he's doing. So,
well, let me say for both our domestic and international audience, something that's rather peculiar about, again, kind of news coverage, and you certainly put your finger on it. About 5 days ago, we had a commuter flight from Minneapolis to Grand Forks, which was diverted to Fargo, North Dakota. And the reason that the diversion took place is that this commuter plane, which was carrying 30 passengers, had a number of students from Pakistan on the flight. They were here on student visas doing research and et cetera in the United States, and they were flying to Grand Forks for whatever reason. A stewardess on the flight maintains that she observed an Arabic-looking individual, who obviously was one of the Pakistanis, had gone into the laboratory on the aircraft, and allegedly she went in. I'm not quite sure. I guess I do. I mean, I know what some of the security protocols, having served on the Department of Justice task force. But she went into the laboratory on the plane. She maintained that the fire extinguisher had been moved, and there was a putty-like substance in the sink, which she reached the conclusion was possibly C4. Okay. Plastic explosion. She ran to the cockpit, and these are the small, you know, twin jet, small commuter aircraft. She indicated to the pilot that there were hijackers aboard. The pilot, as is required by the Federal Aviation Authority and the Civil Authority, he declared an emergency, was diverted to Fargo. Police rushed onto the plane. All of the Muslim-looking, quote-unquote, people were taken off and detained. They checked the substance. The substance had nothing to do with any kind of explosive. The fire extinguisher actually had not been moved. Later, they found out that a maintenance man maintaining the plane prior to takeoff made some adjustment on something. And so now the airlines, you know, it's kind of like the gentleman that had a medical a problem that was put off of an American Airlines plane because they said he couldn't be on there with his wheelchair. Anyways, what's happened on that particular incident is that now it was Pinnacle Airlines, by the way, which is a subsidiary of Northwest Airlines. Oh, well, excuse me, it's now Northwest Delta. Excuse me,
yeah.
Delta, yeah. Pinnacle is a commuter line. Now, you know, I don't see the airlines firing this stewardess, you know what I mean?
No.
Miller indicated she exercised extreme caution because of the suspicious actions of these Muslim-looking people, okay? This just happened here in Minnesota 6 days ago.
Yes, yes. And I have two words, Don Imus. Remember when he went through when he
talked about the lovely, beautiful black sisters from Rutgers?
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
I think he got suspended, but if I'm not mistaken, Mr. Edwards, going back over that just real quick on some Internet Archive, I think he's still working at the same place, making double the money. So.
That's right. They brought they gave him a short hiatus, if you will, and then brought him back and upped his salary, just as Fox did with Juan Williams. Okay.
Exactly.
You know, Juan Williams went from $1 million to $2 million in his new contract. So actually, whatever it was that he said that allegedly turned off, I think her name is Miss Kagan, who is the president of National Public Radio. Whatever he said to turn her off and cause his services to be terminated, it was a $1 million positive hit for him.
Yeah. Well, the NPR president, Mr. Edwards, for full disclosure, Vivian Schiller.
Oh, Schiller, okay.
Yeah, who refused an interview on NPR about the situation on Friday.
On her own network?
On her network, she declined the request for interview, and so did National Public Radio Vice President Ellen Weiss.
Wow.
So it was kind of interesting because there was a big piece done on it because they're trying to do internal damage control, as you know.
Yeah.
And for them just to say, hey, you know, they declined, it seemed pretty strange, but, you know, hopefully the person that anchored that particular show and said that she declined, I hope they have a job Monday morning.
Well, now I saw the day after Juan Williams' termination, mm-hmm. I saw a piece on, in fact, it was CNN, in which she was pretty defiant with respect to the actions that she had taken, and she made some very unflattering comments about Juan Williams as it pertains to, kind of reminded me of Dan Gilbert, the owner of the Cleveland Cavaliers, talking about LeBron James, you know, that, you know, kind of like, black guy needs to understand what the rules are, whatever that's supposed to mean. And she was pretty defiant. She was at the, I don't know if it was the National Press Club or et cetera, it was clear she was at some kind of luncheon, and they asked her about it, and she was pretty defiant. And so I was kind of shocked when I kind of heard that she was now declining interviews, and the hierarchy of National Public Radio were declining interviews to discuss what egregious actions Juan Williams had taken under the auspices of the First Amendment.
Yeah, exactly. I agree 100% on that. Well, to stay in the realm of journalism with integrity, Mr. Edwards, I think we're going to have to revisit Mr. Smith story.
David Cornelius Smith,
and yes. the recent events in chronological order that led to the Star and Tribune publishing a story that Minneapolis police chief, cop who used taser, acted properly by reporter Paul Walsh.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Walsh, by the way, just for our domestic and international listeners, is the quote-unquote legal writer, staff writer for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. In other words, he's supposed to be a legal expert. He's a lawyer also.
Yes, and as we know, on September 9th, 2010, David Cornelius Smith, who happened to be a member of the YMCA in downtown Minneapolis, was tased to death on the sixth floor of that building. Then we had reports here that he was brought to Hennepin County and he was on life support. But let's redirect. I guess we can go to start with the 19th, if I'm not mistaken, on September 17th, 2010. The story on the Star Tribune that said man shot with taser declared brain dead. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
and then again on September 19th, the next story, man hit with taser in police scuffle dies. Okay.
Okay.
Between September 9th when this happened and September 17th, 9 days lapsed where there was no information from the Star and Tribune. There was absolutely nothing. I actually went down, you know, we actually went down as a news network to try to see if we can have access to the security tapes. And executive director of the downtown Minneapolis YMCA, Kathy Rod, said there is no comments. You have to contact our communications department. And we followed up several times. And
we followed and traced the communications director all the way to Vancouver, British Columbia.
Yeah, and still to this day, Mr. Edwards, no callback, no answers to emails, or they're just remaining mum on the whole thing there.
Right, and but we also were part of a group that requested the Minneapolis Civil Rights Department to open a civil rights investigation under color of law into the death of David Cornelius Smith, and of course, Ms. Velma Corvell forgot to mention that she was affiliated with the Y family, if you will. She is on the exec committee of the YWCA, and she forgot to mention that, but she basically told us that under no circumstances would there be any kind of investigation. Now, you wrote a heck of a piece early this morning with respect to Mr. Walsh's comments. Could you just continue to elaborate on this?
Yeah, well, it was very interesting because here's what I get into. I start with, you know, the Minneapolis Police Department. There seems to be an ongoing pattern of police brutality and violence directed at the Minneapolis members of the minority ethnic community, okay? Mm-hmm. Number one, it's not okay for Minneapolis police officers to tell attendees at a funeral to go home or go across the street with the rest of the animals. This was at Mr. Titus's funeral, okay?
Yes.
Number two, it's not okay for the Minneapolis police to tase former radio personality and say he has a weapon when no weapon was found to the next day after he's dead with no way to defend his actions or account for his alleged behavior.
That's Wesley Smith. Okay.
Yeah. And then
December 2008. Go ahead.
Yeah. And then number three, it's heinous. It's a heinous turn of events for a Hmong youth shot 8 times running away from Minneapolis police officer, and the weapon he allegedly had did not have one speck of blood or DNA on it.
Mm-hmm.
Minneapolis Police Chief Tim Dolan should have never told the family that lie. Now we come to David Cornelius Smith, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The story was really surprising. Police said they responded to a complaint that Smith has harassed a 13-year-old boy and noticed that the suspect appeared to be either under the influence of something or having some mental health episode, okay? That's in yesterday's story, or today's story, I should say, from Mr. Paul Walsh.
Okay.
The thing is, on September 19th, the Star and Tribune reported, man hit with taser in police scuffle died. Family members said they were told by hospital personnel that there were no drugs or alcohol in David Smith's system following the incident. He had no health problems, they said. They were told that taser marks were on his back. So with that said, they're counter the stories. All three of these different stories are contradicting each other. And again, Mr. Edwards, you brought up a great point. There is no more homicide counts in the Star and Tribune newspaper anymore.
Absolutely. And we're over 40.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, we're over 40 officially, even officially. If you go back and take a look at the last homicide count that the Minneapolis Star and / the police department gave the general public 3 weeks ago, and you look at what we have already identified on your websites, we are now over 40.
Yeah, and that includes Timothy Wade Wilson, who was shot in the head in North Minneapolis.
Correct.
Mr. Meeks.
Correct.
Mr. Johnson.
Correct.
And Mr. Smith.
Correct.
And then there's two white individuals that were killed. And then last night, we had a cab driver shot in downtown Minneapolis.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
So that's what, seven? That's seven right there?
Seven at least. Seven at least, because the two Caucasians that have taken place along with, and now you have the cab driver's deceased. Is that what they're now confirming? Or did he miraculously recover? Is he on life support?
There is not an update to that, and I was just looking at that here in the other studio here just to get a clarification on that, and I will have that in a minute. But getting back to the Star and Tribune reporting here, there's a big gaps in these stories. I mean, just huge, you know, recognizable gaps that, I mean, they're insulting our intelligence, basically, that we don't follow this and we look at it very closely here. So,
well, you're absolutely right. One of the things that and we here at On Point have a on-hands relationship with this, as we first reported 3 weeks ago on this program, that initially the Minneapolis Star Tribune reporter David Chenin, acting with integrity and transparency, had officially been informed by police spokesman Sergeant Palmer, that the individual arrested and detained was now deceased, that he had died after being tasered. David Chenin, on the 9th of September 2010, interviewed Chief Tim Dolan to ask the question about what did this mean for the department and the ongoing issue and discussion here in the Twin Cities, because allegedly in the last couple of years we've had 8 people die, both of all nationalities and racial backgrounds. We've had 8 to 9 people have been killed by tasering. Okay.
Yes.
David Chenin called on the around, let's say it was around 2:30 on the afternoon of the 9th of September to ask Chief Dolan. He interviewed Chief Dolan. He was around 5 o'clock, thereabouts. He, David Chenin, the reporter for the Star Tribune, was in the process of putting together for the following day's paper, the 10th, a story which indicated that at one point they had Mr. Smith as 18 years old. Okay,
yeah.
He's 28. The Star Tribune was putting together a story that the individual had expired. What happened was Star Tribune received a call from a source who had had a previous conversation with Mr. Chenin, and they had discussed, because Mr. Chenin was trying to get some background with respect to the thinking about these tasers. The source called Mr. Chenin at the Star Tribune back and said, you need to reconsider and you need to check because Mr. Smith is now being identified as surviving on life support. David Chenin did that, and the Star had to put a rush job on and came out with a different story. Now, as you previously indicated, for 9 days, the media and the public were told that Mr. Smith was on life support. But by the way, as was reported in this morning's edition of Mr. Walsh's story, the police have yet to talk to Mr. Smith's family. Now, his family, his mother and others, his brother Larry Smith of Peoria, Illinois, and others have come here on a couple different occasions. They have attempted to meet with the police. They also attempted to meet with representatives of the Downtown Y. These efforts have been rejected. Now, we reported here on point, and all of our programs can be recaptured on demand, as I understand it, Mr. Allen. Am I correct?
You are absolutely correct.
All right. 3 weeks ago, this program, On Point, reported that Dr. Baker, the medical examiner for Hennepin County, would indicate that the death of David Cornelius Smith was a homicide. And, in fact, in our column in the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder, 3 weeks ago, we talked in terms of the death of David Cornelius Smith and that these things would happen. And also, for those naysayers, we talked about the conversation and our knowledge of the David Chenin, the reporter for the Star Tribune situation, and the fact that he had been informed that David Cornelius Smith was dead on the site. In other words, he was dead. He had expired while lying on the floor. Now, another piece that's come out of this, James Walsh or Paul Walsh attempts to write today as if the police officers administrated life-saving techniques. You go back and look at the original story, they maintained they didn't do anything until the ambulance got there.
Exactly. Exactly. And they're lucky they didn't throw a gun down there by him. So.
Well, Will, we're getting ready to move to that. That's another story, a high-powered story, that but let us respect and memorialize Mr. Smith,
yes,
as well as the other victims. We don't want to forget Mr. Johnson either. Johnson, 42-year African-American, hit by a car going 60 miles an hour that plowed into a crowd of people. Killed a young man, a 35-year-old African-American by the name of Mr. Meeks, dies at the scene. Mr. Johnson is taken to the hospital. Deon Johnson is taken to the hospital that Saturday. He has head injuries. He has other body injuries and et cetera. And no one now can even tell you when he was sent home from North Memorial, which is one of the larger hospitals, private hospitals here in Minnesota, just on the edge of the racially mixed community of North Minneapolis. But North Memorial is actually in a suburb called Robbinsdale. This is for our domestic and international audiences. Mr. Johnson is sent home, and sometime around, they can't even get the date right, by the way, and we point that out again in a copyrighted story. Again, we use the word copyrighted story in the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder, that sometime on either late late Monday, early Tuesday, sometime during Tuesday, Mr. Johnson was found in his home dead. Okay. Now, the medical examiner in this situation, and by the way, we reported on this on Blog Radio On Point two programs ago, that the coroner, medical examiner, Hennepin County, Dr. Baker, indicated that not all tests were completed, but we were able to at least, you know, require him, force him to give the name. Now, the Star Tribune initially had said that they were going to write, Amy Simonson and others were going to write about the circumstances of Mr. Johnson being pushed out of the hospital and left to die, which he did. But they have done nothing about it, and the only publication here in Minnesota that has written about Johnson and the deaths of Mr. Johnson and Mr. Meeks and that whole scenario has been the Spokesman Recorder.
Exactly. Yeah, and so there's
as we said before, all of this is documented. We're not sitting here on Blog Radio On Point fantasizing, making these things up. We are operating this afternoon from documentation, empirical documentation.
Exactly. Now, there's a reference to this whole thing, I think, October 4th in the Spokesman Recorder.
That's right. That would be my column.
Yes, and that you have that detailed. If folks want to look that up, they can go to spokesman-recorder.com and just Google Ronald A. Edwards, and the archive of his story will show up that in chronological order where he had talked about this particular incident. So,
with the reporters from the Star Tribune.
Excuse me?
With the reporters from the Star Tribune.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. I mean, what I will do here on this program now, because the person has expired and et cetera, it was I who was the source that indicated to the Star Tribune we were getting ready to go with a story, and at least they needed to correct what it was they were getting ready to impart to the general reading public. Because we were now being told that Mr. Smith had miraculously, word we continue to use, had miraculously been revived and was now on life support. By the way, without naming the people as a part of a confidentiality arrangement we have, one of the two victims, Mr. Meeks and Mr. Johnson, and probably people can figure out, turned out to be a quote-unquote donor to a individual who is now in a local hospital here in the Twin Cities.
Okay.
Remember we said on the program that one of the things that disturbed us were the number of African-Americans in this latest scenario that's being played out in this city as African-Americans are homicide victims and et cetera, is that their organs are being taken from them and then sold at a significant profit to the medical facility. We have now discovered, we will not identify if it was Mr. Meeks or Mr. Johnson, nor will we identify the beneficiary of the organ, but that's what happened, Mr. Allen. That's exclusive here on Point.
Yes, as we suspected going a while back, because these folks, you know, IBNN News, the Independent Business News Network, got an anonymous call from someone that actually works on the sixth floor of the YMCA downtown Minneapolis, who confirmed that Mr. Cornelius Smith, David Cornelius Smith, was handcuffed and was tased and was roughed up pretty bad by the Minneapolis Police Department. And so even though she is not, this particular person is not a medical professional, that they overheard talk that he had expired.
Right.
Up there on the sixth floor. And so, mm-hmm. you know, one of the things when someone expires, if they want to harvest organs, they quickly put them on life support so the machines can do the breathing to keep the blood flowing and a number of things can happen so they can harvest body parts. And you know, I tested, just like you did a while back, that this is what has been going on with a lot of the African-American victims of violence here in the Twin Cities.
That's right. And by the way, that is an appropriate medical term, harvest, mm-hmm. your life-saving body organs, if you will. But it also provides a significant profit to the medical facility in question. We repeat again, in the case of the deaths, which were homicides, of Meeks and Johnson in this city 2 weeks ago, that one of the individual's life organs were harvested and were placed into the body of an individual who is now recovering in a local hospital here.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, yeah, there's a lot going on here. And again, we just have to tell it like it is, Mr. Edwards. None of the social service agencies that are tasked with the advancement of minority ethnic people, I was going to say colored people, but I guess I did, so ooh, there it is, or the capacity building and social justice and, you know, those type organizations in Minneapolis and clergy has stepped up to say anything about this.
Nothing at all. In fact, at one point, the Smith family was told by the NAACP and the American Civil Liberties Union that they would be front and center on this issue. My understanding, recollection, is that you interviewed a high-ranking official of Minneapolis NAACP 2 weeks ago, and their response to you was they would be waiting on seeing what the family is going to do, quote-unquote. When the family's, you know, whole sense of concern and activism and assistance was that these two powerful organizations, at least on paper, were going to be front and center in demanding a grand jury investigation and et cetera. And, of course, there will be no grand jury investigation unless there is specific evidence that can be shown to the federal U.S. Attorney Todd Jones for the Federal District of Minnesota, because Mike Freeman has clearly indicated he doesn't intend to take anything to a grand jury that will be successful as it pertains to African Americans, i.e. the Quincy Smith tragedy, which did not go to a Hennepin County grand jury until August of the following year. Mr.
Yeah.
Smith was killed in December, and it was not until August of 2009 that a grand jury said, oh, doesn't look like there was any impropriety, even though two of the officers involved in the killing of Quincy Smith were being sued, and there had been an affirmative judgment against them in a previous tasering of Mr. Smith 2 years prior in downtown Minneapolis. People don't even talk about that anymore.
No, not at all. Not at all.
Now, you said something earlier, you know, about planted guns. And
yeah.
I just want to update us on there is currently also, again, particularly for our international and domestic audience, because we do get to the trial process here in Minnesota. There is a trial that's been going on for about a week in the federal court here. Federal Judge David Doughty is the presiding judge, as according to the court records. A individual by the name of Dominic Felder was, in fact, shot to death in this city on the 6th of September or thereabouts, Mr. Allen, of 2006. In fact, it was approximately 5 weeks after Fong Lee had been shot and killed by Minneapolis police officers outside of a school here in called City View here in Minneapolis. Dominic Felder, according to the news accounts in the paper Thursday's edition, this past Thursday's edition, if I'm not mistaken, Mr. Allen, reported the trial going on in federal court, and a serious question came up with respect to the tampering with reports. And a white female officer was on the stand and was being questioned about how she had changed her testimony, what she had seen that night when Dominic Felder was shot. Actually, he was shot 6 times at close range. I mean, very, very close range. And how we know about it as a part of our relationship with the federal task force, we were at the site of that call. We were not allowed to go in beyond the crime scene yellow tapes. But we are aware that in the case of Dominic Felder, that there was, in his case, an attempt to plant a gun.
Okay. And what happened to that?
Well, what happened in the case of Dominic Felder, and we are now obligated to reveal this, though we certainly had wanted to reveal it to the attorneys for the Felder family, but there were all kinds of problems. It took a long time for competent legal counsel to be found to push this case forward into the federal courts, and I don't think that Chief Tim Dolan and the mayor and others thought this would ever go to trial, but it has, and how the jury decides we will just have to wait. But what happened that particular night, first of all, if we were, you know, in that we control what happens here at On Point, a call, 911 call came in that an African-American or black man was acting strangely and, in fact, had possibly thrown a rock through the window of a neighbor's home along the 3700, 3800 block of Bloomington Avenue South here in the city of Minneapolis. Two police officers who had had prior relationships and had been involved in controversial actions against African Americans, including one of the officers who had been involved in the shooting and killing of an African American military veteran on leave in this city along the 4600 block of Pleasant Avenue South a couple years before. Okay? These two officers arrived. Their testimony became that Mr. Felder, Dominic Felder, who was a 130-pound African-American at best, 130 pounds, Mr. Allen, not 200 pounds or 500 pounds, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
That Mr. Felder was acting in a strange way, that they attempted to question him and that he began to walk away. And all of a sudden, a number of days later, the officer's statements were that he had put his hand into his waistband as he walked away, and they felt that he had a weapon. The officers then charged him. They maintained that there was a scuffle, and that, as in the case of David Cornelius Smith at the YMCA, that he struck the officers, engaged in a pitched battle. Both these officers are well over 200 pounds. Veteran officers work out daily in the third precinct over there. Where this incident took place, they maintained that there was a hand-to-hand combat, if you will. They're in the middle of the street on Bloomington, and at some point or another, the stories kind of vary. At one point, the officer had already drawn his weapon. At another point, the other officer said that he saw Mr. Felder reaching for the other officer's weapon, and that he then drew his weapon and opened fire. Testimony from some neighbors, which was later suppressed, was that actually these officers actually grabbed Mr. Felder under really both of his arms, and that one of the officers then took his Glock 9mm, pressed it against Mr. Felder's midsection and opened fire, and then the other officer at least fired two shots.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah, they executed him. Now, what happened was, after the call went out, of course, all kinds of police and inspectors and everybody rushed to the scene. And one of the first officers there, because he lived close to the immediate area, was one of the most outstanding black officers in the Minneapolis Police Department, Lieutenant Mario Arredondo, who happened, and one of the reasons he got the call very quickly is that he, at that time, Mr. Allen, was what is called, he was the compliance officer for the federal mediation agreement that had been imposed and agreed to by the city of Minneapolis that had created the committee that I was serving on, the Police Community Relations Committee. Lieutenant Arredondo rushed to the scene and actually got there before some of the sergeants and before other certain personnel could arrive. Now, you have to understand, this was about 5 weeks after the very controversial shooting death of Fong Lee in North Minneapolis, where a weapon all of a sudden showed up. When Lieutenant Arredondo arrived, because of his familiarity and because he was present during some of the discussions within the Police Community Relations Council about the death of Fong Lee, and because he is a very qualified police officer. By the way, he went to the FBI Academy in Washington, D.C. He's actually an African-American officer until he sued the department that was online to become an inspector of police, possibly assistant chief. And he's a young brother, okay? But anyway, when he arrived there, of course, there was no weapon. What happened was another group of white commanders and et cetera arrived, and Lieutenant Arredondo was told to go up the street where a group of individuals, including yours truly, had gathered and were asking questions. And part of that group was the grandmother of Dominic Felder and two of his aunts, okay? And they were asking some very tough questions. In fact, we had to restrain them. Lieutenant Arredondo and myself had to restrain them because they actually wanted to break through the tapes. And, of course, if you do that, technically the police can arrest you or even shoot you, okay?
Yes, yes.
What happened, though, was the move to send Lieutenant Arredondo a block and a half up the street. And, by the way, the crime scene now had become almost a three-block radius, okay? We had crime tape in almost a three-block radius. So the family and et cetera were standing, were pushed almost a block and a quarter back. What happened was the move was getting ready to be made, and a very high-ranking captain of the National Police Department arrived. He was not trusted as it pertains to those that were getting ready to put a weapon in close proximity to Mr. Felder, okay? He could not be ordered from the scene because he happened to also be the commander of the CID, the Criminal Investigative Division. That individual was the person that actually, by his presence, and the fact, that he could not be trusted to play the game, what then happened was that no gun was positioned or placed. Now, that captain is now the sheriff of Hennepin County, the Honorable Sheriff Richard Stanick.
Okay.
Now, this is the first time, Mr. Allen, that this has been revealed. Unfortunately, the attorney for Mr. Felder did not seek out witnesses during discovery that this information could have been brought to their attention in an appropriate manner.
Yeah, there's a lot going on with that kind of stuff, and it's you heard it here first on Point, and we've been breaking a lot of news like that. But this goes back to the ongoing series where the Minneapolis police have, I think, overstepped their boundaries in some cases and done some really heinous actions that they really don't have to answer for as long as Mike Freeman is the county attorney.
We're getting some echo back. I don't know if that's my set here or whatever. We have another case, though, that we really want to lay out because there was great interest in our city because we actually showed on our television program the video of this African-American being beaten by the police, and that video also disproved the probable cause that the police stated as the reason for initially stopping this African-American and beating him almost into unconsciousness. This is Mr. Ira Saffron, who you also know, Mr. Allen.
Yes, I do.
That case is currently in the federal court, and they're in the process of discovery doing the television showing of the video of the beating of Mr. Saffron while the music, country western music of Willie Nelson was playing in the background. And this is actually what happened. When the police pulled up, they were playing Willie Nelson, because one of the things white officers in this city do a lot is that they said they're sick and tired listening to that jungle music, so they have a little network in which they play a lot of country western music. And in the video that we showed on my television program, as they were beating Mr. Safford in front of his truck and holding guns to the heads of the two other African Americans who were riding with him, by the way, they were never charged with anything.
No.
Willie Nelson and the country western was playing in the background. It was quite macabre, to say the least, as I think you would agree. You and thousands of others had a chance to see that video a little over a year ago. But anyways, wanted to update folks that in the case of the police beating of Ira Safford, that is getting ready to go to trial in the federal court also.
Yeah, and that's good for Ira, because I remember this, Mr. Edwards, about a year ago when WCCL Channel 4 here in the Twin Cities played a sanitized version of that particular video.
Sanitized. Thank you. Go ahead, sir.
And then the video that I had an opportunity to view clearly showed that the probable cause, you know, the police said for pulling him over was that his brake lights weren't working. And I actually saw his brake light on when the tow truck had put his truck up, or his vehicle up on the slate there.
On the bed of the truck, that's right.
And I'm saying, okay, now it looks like his brake lights are working fine.
Right.
No, And so that totally washed out. And again, there was no reprimand or punishment for this, evident lie from the patrol officers.
Now, by the way, that video, which was shown by African American journalist yourself, and well, it was shown on my TV program. That tape, that video also, you cannot vote, you cannot see this, but you can hear it because they left their recording on in the squad car. You can also, again, for our international and domestic listeners, you can hear them beating Mr. Safford in the back seat of the car. Remember that?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
And it'll be interesting to see how the city and the police department deal with that, because I have a case right now of a group of African Americans that were beaten in a home, young people who unfortunately were in a house. Police came in, but in the course of beating them and really calling them some names that are rather disturbing. When the parents of some of these young people went to the police, the first thing that the police said is, we don't use language like that, and we don't beat people. Now, this video, which obviously they must have forgotten, clearly shows the beating of Mr. Safford, and it clearly shows, and you can hear him also being beat in the back seat of the squad car after he was put in the squad car. But I want to go back to the Dominic Felter, so people are absolutely clear on that, is that there would have been a gun dropped if not for the presence of then Captain Richard Stanek, now Sheriff of Hennepin County, because they did not trust him, and rightly so. He's a real straightforward, by-the-book police officer, okay? But it was he and Lieutenant Arredondo that's really, by their presence, not so everyone is clear, not that they saw it, but as police officers, they knew what the modus operandi, the pattern in practice, as we call it, was to have been. But they were not able to drop a gun. Now, you got to remember, initially, they maintained that the suspect, the deceased, had a weapon. But Arredondo, Lieutenant Arredondo, got there too quick. Captain Stanek got there too quick. They never were able to drop the gun. And so the testimony in federal court this past week has been, we thought he had a gun. He made a move which indicated to us. Now, as I said before, and I want to repeat this because it was such a tragedy out there that night, the emotions and the heartbreak of his family members. Got to remember, first of all, Dominic Felter was 130 pounds at best. I think his weight at the time of autopsy was 126 pounds, Mr. Allen. As I said before, witnesses who had been suppressed indicated the officers actually picked him up on each side, and one of those officers took his gun from the right side, where his holster, took his gun, pointed it into his body, and shot him. In fact, I was surprised he didn't shoot his colleague. Okay? And then his colleague, his partner, then fired at least two shots into Mr. Felder's body.
Wow.
Dominic Felder, yeah. That case currently in the federal courts here in Minnesota.
Well, let's hope that there's some justice served in this particular case.
Right,
'Cause this
right.
is just, it's a warning sign for anybody, darker than the shade of khaki traveling in the streets of the Minneapolis or the Twin Cities, that, if you get pulled over for a speeding ticket, parking, moving violation, you are at risk depending on the words coming out of your mouth.
And sometimes it doesn't have to be the words. We have a couple of cases and I've been doing this, as many folks know, for years, is that I've been the person that folks have come to oftentimes is to ask them, that they have asked me to advocate for them, to help them. And we're talking about Minneapolis, St. Paul, and around the state. And so we have become, unfortunately, very familiar and very expert on what the modus operandi pattern and practices is, if you will. We've seen cases where you don't even have to say anything wrong. It's just the fact that the officer's having a bad day.
Oh,
Now, what you can hope for is that he's having a bad day. That doesn't mean you have a fatal day.
Exactly.
Okay? Mr. Allen, please give the number again. I'm interested to hear if any of our top-notch organizations here, or even, I wonder if some of them even know about these cases, even though they're in the major newspapers.
Yeah, exactly. That number again is 1-877-572-4288. Again, the number is 1-877-572-4288. It's a toll-free number. Feel free to call. And while we're still under the
How much time do we have, just so our any caller who is tempted to call in knows?
Yeah, 20 minutes left in the show.
All right, then. I thought we were right on point. Thank you, sir. All right. Go right ahead, Mr. Allen. I'm sorry.
So we're doing great. You know, it kind of shocks me because, you know, both of us, you and I, Mr. Edwards, we have been talking about this, about these agencies that are have their hands so deep. And when I say agencies, I mean nonprofits like the Urban League, NAACP. Well, NAACP doesn't really have their hands deep in anybody's pocket. They're trying to still figure out their mission here locally.
Right.
And
right.
But the Urban League, Shiloh Church.
By the way, Shiloh will be issuing a report on crime and violence, won't they, on the 9th of November? Give us that date, if you would, please.
Save the date, Saturday, October 30th, from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. There's a town hall meeting at Shiloh Temple at 1201 West Broadway. They republished a report on violence in North Minneapolis and will be presented by the report by contributors, followed by a panel discussion.
Yes. The panel. I wonder who that panel will consist of.
Well, you know, we're going to be on the phone Monday and see if we can't get these folks on the air Saturday. So,
I'd love to. And what time is that again here in Minneapolis?
It's 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. So you have a couple hours there to talk about violence. And,
On Saturday.
Okay. On the 30th. So
give the address, if you will, of Shiloh International Ministries.
The address for Shiloh is International Ministries is 1201. That's 1201 West Broadway. They ask that you RSVP. So just, you know, Google Shiloh or call 612-543-2556 and reserve your spot. And so this is sponsored by North Point Health and Wellness, Shiloh Temple, the Foundry USA, who I have no idea what they are, and Wellspring Second Chance Center. So,
all right. This is outstanding. I mean, a report that's going to give us an in-depth look. And really what we're doing is getting a little something for that $245,000 that was given to Shiloh International Ministries this time last year, right?
Exactly.
Oh, this is outstanding. Well, let us just say to our listening audience, we will certainly be in a position next Saturday to highlight and critique this almost unprecedented town hall meeting.
Yeah, and Mr. Edwards, I'm sitting here in another studio, and I'm doing a Google search for the Foundry USA, and I'm just trying to find out what they're about, and I don't see anything, but maybe if I put Minneapolis afterwards, something might come up, because it seems to be, they're nothing. So that'd be very interesting.
Do you think that this organization got funded identified maybe by the Ecumenicals as a source and got funded? And maybe we can find their 990.
Yeah, maybe that might be somewhere where we can get a hold of it, because what I'm going to do is I have everybody on the air here. I mean, we just need to see if we can find out a little bit more information about what's going on here. And
let me just say to our audience, because the reason we're really on this is in the last 3 or 4 minutes, these are the kinds of activities that have, you know, quote unquote, well-funded some of our leadership, ecumenical, civil, and et cetera. See, these reports come out, and then they go meet with McKnight or somebody like that, and they get all kinds of money because they say that we're addressing the problem. Am I correct?
Yeah, you're absolutely correct.
Okay. And so this is important for our community, because I would imagine, from what I'm hearing, and particularly in light of the fact that we're not able to identify who the founders are,
yeah, exactly.
Is that this could be worth another $250,000 to $300,000 for Shiloh Ministries, the Achievement Zone, Peace Foundation, and groups like that, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Well, yeah, Mr. Edwards, I want to just take a shot and see if we can get some information.
Okay.
So, can you hear the phone ringing?
Yes, I can. Are we calling the Foundry, or are we calling the Peace Foundation?
We're actually calling Shiloh to see if we can get some information on the town hall meeting.
I think that's excellent.
Okay, we'll see if anybody answers this number. I dialed the...
You have reached North Point Health and Wellness Center Administration.
It's the North Point that you call. Okay, and we know they're closed on Saturdays.
Something just jogged my memory, Mr. Allen, and we apologize for the lack of absolute clarity. That's right, because in one of the announcements that I heard, what is being said is that the report was actually commissioned by North Point Wellness Center / the County, Hennepin County, and Shiloh International Ministries. That's right. That's right. They allegedly commissioned this reported study. Do we have a telephone number for the organization identified as the Founders or Foundries? Or
the
Foundries.
No, we don't, but I have a number here for Shiloh.
Let's call Shiloh.
I just found that number here, and we're going to see if they answer the phone here because I'm kind of interested in what's on the air or what's.
Thank you for calling Shiloh Temple International Ministries.
Hello, you're live on the air with On Point with Don Allen and Ron Edwards. We're trying to find out some information about your town hall meeting that you have on October 30th. Who am I speaking with?
Yes, sir. Pardon me?
Who am I speaking with?
This is Bishop Howell.
Bishop Howell.
Bishop Howell. Well, how happy we are to hear your voice. Go right ahead, Mr. Allen.
Good to hear your voice.
Yeah, well, the Lord works in mysterious ways, Bishop Howell.
He really does. I don't normally answer phones at 5:15 on a Saturday afternoon.
Okay.
Well, we have you
Mr.
live.
Allen, go ahead.
This is a live broadcast going across all of the country and all of Minnesota. And we're kind of interested about the town hall meeting that's coming up on Saturday, October 30th. And we only have a short time today, but we'd like to invite you on the air on this coming Saturday and whoever else you'd like to kind of talk about this with our listening audience.
Well, thank you very much. This is a result of a study that was conducted by Dr. Williams, who did a study on the North Side violence and why there's so much violence in the past. And so he's going to report his findings now. This coming day.
Bishop Howell, Ron Edwards, how you doing?
And
who is Dr. Williams? Could you give us a little bit more background on his credentials?
His story. There will also be a panel discussion to share their thoughts and feelings about what we can do as a community for such a time as this.
Okay.
It definitely, I think, is a very timely time for the community to finally come together, and maybe that this will be one way that we can save our community in addition to the fine community folks who've been working for this end anyhow for a long time.
Bishop Howell, again, who is Dr. Williams?
Do you want, and where are you located?
I'm located on the internet. We broadcast live from the McIntosh Studios in downtown Minneapolis. And my co-host, Mr. Edwards, is on the air, but I don't have – we just took a chance calling you, so I didn't link that in so you can hear him. But his question, just real quick here – we're on the air on Saturdays at 4 p.m. every Saturday, but his question, you had mentioned that Dr. Williams. Can you give us a little detail about Dr. Williams and some...
I wish I could. Okay. You know, I wish I could, and I can't because I don't really know him, but there's a lot of people that do. I understand he used to teach. He was a professor at the University of Minnesota.
Okay.
And you probably need a bio, and I'm the wrong person now at this point.
Okay. I'll tell you what... Bishop Howell, I will make sure that I get in touch with you and drop you off the information on all you do is pick up the phone and dial or switchboard and let you right into the show. And I will promote it all next week for you so you know that people know about this and also that you'll be calling in and having that conversation with us. And you can actually have two or three of your folks, including you, call in and we just can have a discussion. And we'll
that'd be great.
Yeah, then we'll
listen, can I write your bio tank, write something down right now, your contact information?
Sure. My number is public, and I'll actually just give you the my company's number. That number is 6.
Okay, and I'm going to have someone call you directly.
Okay, that number is 612.
Here we go. What's that right there?
Okay.
612.
Yes. 986.
986.
Yeah, 0010.
0010, 612-986-0010.
Yeah, this is Don Allen and with the Independent Business News Network. So I would love to have you on the show next Saturday, and I'll make sure that I get dropped something off by there so that you have easy access and how to get in touch with the radio show at 4 p.m. on this coming Saturday.
Great, Don.
Hey, thank you for your time, sir.
Thank you for calling.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Mr. Edwards.
Yeah, I'm so sorry, that, and we apologize to our audience. We were so surprised by being able to capture Bishop Howell at his location that Mr. Allen had not patched me in. But excellent job. So that is that, that as they say in London, that was just capital. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so we'll be looking forward now, so that our listening audience, domestic and international, are clear on this. You will be talking with representatives of Bishop Howe and Shiloh International Ministries, and they are basically at this point committed to share with us by 4 o'clock next Saturday the report by this Dr. Williams. There aren't that many Dr. Williamses per se at the University of Minnesota in the area of psychology or human behavior or crime and justice. Maybe certainly we will have that in place so that you can post that on our mutual websites. Because I'm fascinated to know who Dr. Williams is.
Yeah, I am very interested at this point because I have never heard of a Dr. Williams. Well, the dentist on Broadway Avenue, which my parents used to go to.
And, John Williams.
John Williams, yes.
Yeah.
And then Andy Williams, a country singer. No, I'm just kidding. But, I don't have any idea, but neither does Bishop Howes. And, you know, when you're commissioning a report, you know, just in my thoughts, just from a business perspective, I guess you should know who the people are that's working on this report.
Yes, you should. And maybe what we'll have to do is that maybe let us do this, because we like to lay out to audience, domestic and international, how we work. I think it'll be imperative that on Monday that we contact the office of County Commissioner Mark Stengline. Because
yeah.
The wellness center, which is attached to the county, in other words, it is controlled, and the county is the prime authority. Maybe Mark Stengline, who is also the county commissioner for the area of some of the greatest violence in North Minneapolis, maybe he can help us with respect to Dr. Williams. Now, here's a couple things that I'm going to be asking for on this end as it pertains to the Rondax Group and et cetera. Like to know when the study was commissioned, who Dr. Williams is, what his credentials are, and what was the compensation paid to Dr. Williams or the organization he's affiliated with. I think that's fair, don't you, Mr. Allen?
Yeah, I think that's very fair.
And we need information also on the founders of this group. Is that a foundation? Is it a criminal justice task force? Is it somebody involved? Because I thought that I saw the founder's name in some documents we were looking at 6 weeks ago when we were talking quite a bit about Operation Ceasefire. You remember Operation Ceasefire that did not get here?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it fell flat on its face. And I thought that I remembered Bishop Howe in some interview indicating something about the founders at the time that Shiloh International Ministries and others thought that they were going to be recipients of the $2.2 million that they thought was coming here, but the Department of Justice went in another direction with four different cities. Remember that?
Yes, I do. I remember exactly what the whole turn of events with that. So.
Yes. Well, we're down to, what, the last 5 minutes, Mr. Allen?
Anything else we should
be looking at?
7 minutes left here, and we just want to, you know, let people...
Light rail. We were missed on that. We were at that meeting.
And go ahead, Ms. Edwards.
Just wanted to let folks know that the light rail subcommittees, the light rail that's supposed to be coming into North Minneapolis, which will not only provide significant modern transportation, but a lot of jobs, I would assume. We hear a price being quoted as much as, what, $300 million, Mr. Allen?
Yes.
Conservative estimate.
Conservative.
Mr. Allen and myself were present at a meeting of the, what is it called, the Northside Transportation Committee?
Northside Transportation Network.
Network. And they have a website. Could you just give us the website, Mr. Allen?
Yes, the website is northsidetransportationnetwork.org.
Okay. And on that website, again, to our national and international listeners, is a critique, timelines, other undertakings, if you will, that will take place in this almost half a billion dollar project, which will go through North Minneapolis. It'll be taking some homes, possibly as many as 100 homes of a majority of African-American citizens, but I assume that there's some kind of relocation plan. Do you know we've never used the word relocation, Mr. Allen?
No, we haven't.
Yeah. I don't know why that is, because many black families will be displaced by this. But anyways, we had a meeting, excellent meeting, three-hour meeting in the Van White Room at the Minneapolis Urban League, and there will be a follow-up meeting on, is it the 4th of November?
The 4th of November, yes.
Right, and at the Urban League, and then there will be a much bigger meeting. Is that the 17th of November, Mr. Allen?
That would be the 18th of November.
I'm sorry, 18th, the week before Thanksgiving, in which there will be a large town hall, a popular word nowadays,
yeah.
A town hall style meeting to begin to talk in terms of additional preparation. Now, these meetings have been going on for 10 months.
Yes.
So we think that we're a long ways away. If I could, Mr. Allen, impose on you, if you just could give that website again, because many of our people can just lock into that website and get all kinds of information.
Yes, it's the NorthsideTransportationNetwork.org. All one word, NorthsideTransportationNetwork.org.
Okay. Now, for those of you here in our cities that have relatives and friends in St. Paul, you know that this has been quite an undertaking over there. Light rail will be going down University Avenue, which is one of the main thoroughfares in St. Paul. In fact, University Avenue, you take University Avenue from Minneapolis, it will take you straight to the state capitol.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And so this is a biggie, big dollars, if you will. The line will be starting in a suburb called Maple Grove, which is a very affluent suburb to the west of Minneapolis, coming in and going through North Minneapolis on its way to downtown and to the sports centers and sports
yes.
stadiums, if you will. So there will be a lot of contracts and jobs and things like that, right?
Well, we would hope.
Okay. All right.
Yeah,
okay.
All right.
Okay. Well, I guess we're about to move towards a wrap, Mr. Allen. Anything in addition on your side there?
Well, we just want to let our listeners know we have a little bit less than 3 minutes left, but we'd like to let our listeners know that they can review your column every week at the spokesman-recorder.com. And tomorrow, for those in Minneapolis, Channel 17, Minneapolis Television Network, at 5 p.m. for Black Focus. And also keep up to date in real-time news that it concerns you on the Independent Business News Network, and that is IBNNnews.com, and also USARadicalBlack.com, which is a nationally focused, African-American focused media outlet where we cover national stories. And speaking of, we have a little bit under 2 minutes, speaking of national stories here, Mr. Edwards, you remember the beating at the Cracker Barrel in Georgia, September 2009?
Yes, an African-American woman who was in the United States military, her and her daughter beaten by a white separatist. Yes, I do. Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Troy Dale West Jr., who had started the was in the altercation, we don't want to say started, has been sentenced to 6 months in jail, and he's been in jail already for 40 days.
Oh, okay.
They had officially, in a plea deal, gave him 6 months in jail. So
okay. And that happened at the Cracker Barrel there in Georgia.
Yes.
Excellent. Okay, that just came across the news. I know we only were down probably about to a minute, 10 seconds. Did we get any confirmation on what were the consequences of the shooting of the cab driver in downtown Minneapolis?
No, they said that he is expected to survive. I just looked at that. And,
all right, then. Okay.
He is expected to survive, so we'll go from there.
All right. Well, we want to wrap. We want to thank our listeners, both domestic and international, and next week we're looking for a real top-notch program, although we feel all of our programs have been top-notch, but we're looking for a real top-notch program because we will be getting a final report on the reason for violence in the city of Minneapolis this past summer.
Yes. So I'd like to say thank you to our international and national listeners and local listeners here in the Twin Cities. You've been listening to 90 Minutes On Point with your host Don Allen and Ron Edwards. We'll be back next week, next Saturday at 4 p.m. So tune in, let your friends know. Tune in from the comfort of your home computer or your smartphone device. Have a great rest of the weekend. Mr. Edwards?
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Look, this isn't a Romulan labor camp. I don't have to answer your questions. I don't give a damn what you think.
The name of this tune is Mississippi Goddamn.
It's 5:30.